Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 13th of July. This hour, we have a lot of questions to ask, but I guess the overall question is, what are the barriers to student learning posed by conditions of poverty? Are there schools that have been able to very successfully educate students who are living in conditions of poverty? Are there certain systems that educate students who are living in conditions of poverty better than other systems? Our guest this hour is Paul Tough. He is a New York Times Magazine contributor, author of Whatever It Takes, Jeffrey Canada's Quest to Change Harlem and America. And he wrote a piece in the Sunday New York Times Magazine section, which perhaps you saw, that looks at education reform in this country. No, seriously, no excuses. Here's our phone number as we talk about reform, education, and how we're faring in this country. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you would like to send an email, that would be just fine. It's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, Paul.
Hello.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We were talking last hour about all that's going on with the debt ceiling in Minnesota and the recall elections in Wisconsin and how we just can't get together and agree on much of anything. And I was thinking, and I brought up the second hour conversation, we can't agree on education either. We can't figure out, you know, which kind of system is going to educate our students and whether or not we have too much money in our schools or not enough money in our schools. Are charter schools better than public schools? Are voucher schools the way to go? We just can't have a serious debate where we have consensus, can we?
I think you're right. I mean, I'm hopeful that we can get there, but you're absolutely right that right now we're not having that debate. And I think what's happened, especially in the last few years in education, is that it's turned into a debate much like other debates, national debates and Washington, D.C. debates, where there are two increasingly rigid sides.
Yes.
That disagree about everything. And I feel like their positions just continue to harden. I find that increasingly a distraction from trying to find real solutions to the real problems that we have with educating kids and especially educating poor kids.
So we've had about 10 years of education reform, which has taken different forms. What has worked from what you've looked at?
Well, I feel like a couple things have worked. One is on the national stage, I do feel like there's been one big advantage to No Child Left Behind, the federal law that came in 2002. And that is that it has focused our minds on what the big problem is in education. It, because of the way it insisted that states and schools look at their statistics, it made it much more hard to cover up low performance by certain demographic groups, by minorities and low-income kids especially. So the nature of the problem and the stickiness of the problem, I think, is much more evident now than it was 10 years ago. Of course, that doesn't necessarily help us solve the problem, but it certainly explains better what it is. The other thing that I think has really worked over the last 10 years or so is that there are certain schools, to my mind, it's certain specific charter schools that have been the most successful, that have found a new and targeted way of educating low-income kids. There are lots of debates about how effective these schools are and what kind of kids they're effective with. But some of these schools, some of their results are just really spectacular. They're able to take kids who are well behind, who come from low-income families, and by giving them extra attention, different kinds of attention, and really engaged teaching, they're able to accelerate them over the course of their school career to where they're performing at really high levels.
And does that require more money, better teachers, longer school years?
You know, there's a big debate about what it requires. I think, here's my guess. My guess is that it does require more time. It does require a longer school day and a longer school year. I think it requires a very high level of teacher. I'm not sure, you know, I think it's a big question how best we measure teachers and how we can tell which teachers are best suited to teach in these sorts of schools. I don't think it's for everyone, absolutely, and I'm not sure that the kind of skills, the kind of sort of personal ability to engage with students that works best in those schools is necessarily going to serve a teacher well in every school. But I would say that high-quality teaching and the extra hours are probably the most important ingredients, though they're not the only ones.
You, after you wrote your piece in the Sunday magazine, you got a response from an education analyst and researcher with the Thomas Fordham Institute, in which he asked you and all of us to try an exercise. This fall, about 1 million poor children will enroll in kindergarten in this country, the vast majority living in single-parent families headed by women in their late teens or early 20s. When designing a school accountability system, what should its objectives be with respect to these 1 million children? I think that's an excellent question.
I think so, too. And I wrote a blog post on the New York Times Magazine's blog trying to highlight this man, Michael Petrilli's sort of thought experiment, because I thought it did really put it in a way that hit home for me really on an emotional level. Here are these million kids who we really do not yet have a system in place that is going to get them to college or through college. And, you know, they're in kindergarten. They're only 4 or 5 right now. They're about to start school in the fall. And it just seems like, you know, when you take a 5-year-old, we really should be able to, putting all of our abilities and resources as Americans together, we really should be able to achieve anything with those kids. But he's absolutely right that the system that we have right now is not going to get them there. Where I disagree with him is, you know, he's a real pragmatist. I would go as far as to say sort of a little pessimistic, and he thinks that the best we can do is to increase our numbers over the course of these kids' school careers by a few percent, so that maybe 90,000 of those 1 million are proficient in math by the time they finish high school. I would like to think that starting where we are, we can get them a lot further, and I think there's evidence from certain schools that we could do a lot better. But I think you've got the question absolutely right, that looking at those kids and saying, how much do we want to commit to getting them to a better place, and what tools would help get them there, is exactly the right question for us all to be asking.
We're having, as you know, this big debate in the state of Wisconsin, which has been going on for some time now, because we were at the forefront of voucher schools. There is a big, huge political debate, as you well know, in the state of Wisconsin on lots of issues, but it does concern education in large measure. There is a move to expand voucher schools pretty extensively in Wisconsin to cities outside the city of Milwaukee, and an expansion there will be of voucher schools in Milwaukee. Can you talk about this debate, which is going on hot and heavy in Wisconsin? I'm not sure how strong it is in other parts of the country, about the best way to educate all students, and for purposes of our conversation, poor students. Are voucher schools the way to go? Why is it that we're seeing so much political conversation about changing the way we educate students?
I'd be happy to try and take that on. I should preface it by saying that I don't know as much about the specific Wisconsin issues as probably just about any of your listeners. So I don't want to get too specific, but my sense about what's happening with vouchers is that, you know, there is this very real debate about whether they are effective or ineffective, and I think there are studies on both sides that say maybe they raise kids' results a little bit, maybe they don't. But it really, vouchers has always struck me as a distraction from the questions that are most important. I mean, I think it does seem clear at this point that vouchers are certainly not the answer, that people who 10 and 15 years ago first started embracing them were convinced that they were going to transform education for poor families. And my sense of the evidence from Wisconsin and elsewhere is that they haven't done that. Even if you're on the side that says that they've worked, it's hard to argue that they've really changed the situation that most poor kids find themselves in. And so to me, the fact that we get so heated about that issue when there are lots of other issues, I think, that would be more useful to be talking about, is what's frustrating to me and what makes me feel like a lot of the debate has gone astray.
Mm-hmm. You talk in your article about Diane Ravitch, who last month, the education scholar who last month wrote an op-ed for the newspaper arguing that raising high-poverty schools to consistently high levels of proficiency is much more difficult and less common than reformers have made it out to be.
Yes, well, she published this op-ed in the Times that made some pretty devastating points. It talked about a couple of specific schools that President Obama and Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education, and other leaders had held up as really successful schools that had undergone a big transformation. And when she looked at their results, they just weren't all that impressive. That there were some schools that had managed, for instance, to raise their high school graduation rate, which is certainly good and important. But the abilities of those kids as they were graduating from high school, whether as measured by the ACT or other standardized tests, were not very good. They weren't really ready for college, even if they were graduating from high school. And there were lots of other numbers that she was able to point to that suggested that some of these schools that the president and others were holding up were really should not be considered successes. And that's really where my column came from. And this headline, "No Seriously, No Excuses," was directed at reformers, was saying that, you know, when the reform movement began 10 years ago, one of its big slogans was "No Excuses," was saying we're not going to use poverty as an excuse. We're going to say that schools in high-poverty neighborhoods, students can succeed to the same high levels as students anywhere, and we're going to hold ourselves accountable to getting those students there. And to me, the fact that the president, say, in the State of the Union, is holding up a school that in terms of their middle school scores, is at the first percentile of success in the state of Colorado, that's kind of depressing because one would assume that he could choose any school he wanted,
right,
in the country to have as an example. And so to me, that sort of encourages defeatism. If you say, well, if the president could pick any school and he picks one that's still doing so badly, maybe this is impossible. Maybe it is impossible to get kids to high levels of success. I don't think that's true. I think that Diane Ravitch has sometimes strayed too far in that sort of pessimistic direction. But I think in this case, she was absolutely right that those examples tell a very different story than the president was hoping they would.
And yet you pull right about what needs to happen, and it just sort of knocks you over. Supplementing classroom strategies with targeted evidence-based interventions outside the home, working intensively with the most disadvantaged families to improve home environments, providing high-quality early childhood education, providing low-income students with a robust system of emotional and psychological support as well as academic support. I'm sorry, I just don't see that happening very much.
Sure, I can understand where you're coming from, and that paragraph was definitely sort of a shorthand attempt to write about or to explain a lot of the interventions that I'm seeing now. I'm working on a new book that is going to talk about a lot of these issues about what's going on with kids in poverty and what kind of interventions seem to really help them.
Great.
And part of what I was trying to do in that list, where I really differ, you know, so I wrote in this piece how I differ with people on the education reform side, but I also feel like I differ with people on Diane Ravitch's side, the critics of the education reform movement, because I feel like when they get they're very good at criticizing what's going on the ed reform side, but when it comes their moment to say what they would do to change things to help poor kids succeed, my sense is that their solutions are about total social transformation. They're about, you know, universal health care and raising the minimum wage and strengthening unions and big social changes, which may or may not be good ideas, but which don't actually seem all that directly relevant to the success of kids in low-income schools. I think are part of a huge national debate about safety net and the social contract and how we want to help families in trouble. What I was trying to do with that list is say, if you look at the research in terms of which kids from low-income homes succeed and which don't, there's actually some really interesting information about what will help kids succeed. And it is not actually about necessarily raising the income level of their families. Families can stay poor, and the kids in them can still succeed. What seems to work, partly certainly there are certain school-based interventions that work, extended school day, extended school year, certain types of intensive high-quality school experiences. But also there are programs that, for instance, do home visiting with low-income mothers, especially first-time teenage mothers. And by changing the way that they interact with their kids, can have a huge effect on their kids' emotional state, but also their cognitive abilities once they reach kindergarten. There are certainly some center-based preschool programs. I've been writing about the EduCare program that is in Chicago and a few other cities. That's a very intensive preschool program targeted at the most disadvantaged families that starts as early as 6 weeks and goes right up to kindergarten. And I feel like right now what we do with Head Start and other pre-kindergarten programs tends to be not very focused and tends actually not to be very evidence-based. It's not actually drawing on what we now know about what happens in the early years, especially in low-income homes. And I think if we're having that debate more actively and more robustly right now, there's a lot that we could be changing and be improving in terms of what kind of supports can get those most disadvantaged kids into the school system so much better prepared and so much better able than they are today.
We welcome phone calls. We don't even need to welcome them because all I had to do was say, here you are, and our phone lines were filled. So we'll take calls momentarily. Paul Tough is our guest. He wrote a piece that's in the New York Times Sunday magazine. No, seriously, No Excuses is the name of it. He is a contributing writer for the magazine, author of Whatever It Takes, Jeffrey Canada's Quest to Change Harlem and America, and he has a new book coming out. We'll ask him when. The Success Equation, I guess it will be published next year, we hope early next year, because it would be great to know about the strategies that work and then just go do it. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your calls, starting with Kit in Sherwood. Hi, Kit.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you. I want to say that I read your guest's article with great interest this weekend. I thought it was very good and very thought-provoking. I have an observation and then a question. In the area that I live in Milwaukee, we've had, I guess I would call it an experiment with the use of voucher schools for about 15 or 18 years now. And the thing about it that's always bothered me is that there's been a real lack of accountability as to what those schools are doing in educating children. And as far as I can see, there's been very little clear proof that they do a better job than the public schools do. The one thing that is clear is that it's cheaper. So it's cheaper for the state to issue a voucher for a child than it is to pay for that child to be educated through the public school. So here's my question. It sounds like there are a number of evidence-based interventions that are proven to work. And my question is, why is it so difficult to replicate those? And is it in large part because they're just really expensive? And at this point, we don't have the political will to invest in those? So I'll take your comments off the
air. Those are great questions, Kit. You are right on the mark. Paul.
Those are great questions, and I'll do my best to take them on. So why don't we do the things that work? Well, I mean, I think there are a few reasons. I think with some of these programs, the evidence is still coming in, and there's still some debates about how well they work, and so people are reluctant to commit to huge change in order to make them happen. But I think there are also lots of political reasons why we don't do them. So take, for instance, the KIPP, the Knowledge is Power program, charter schools. To me, I've been writing about KIPP now for 5 years, and I'm not a full-throated KIPP backer. I think that there are some some limitations to what they do. I'm not convinced that they can serve every child, but I am very impressed with the way that they serve large numbers of low-income kids. Their methods seem to be replicable. They continue to open new schools. I think they have 70 or 80 now across the country. And consistently, their results for the kids who enroll in their schools are much better than any other system of schools that I've seen. So why aren't there KIPP schools all over the place? I think that part of it is just that they're caught in this big debate over education reform, that these are charter schools, and there are lots of people who are opposed to charter schools and lots of people on the other side who are trying to make similar political points. They have an extended school day and an extended school year. I think the kids in those schools end up spending 60% more time in class, so it's not just slightly extended. It's you know, really a whole different system of education. And I don't think there's a school system out there that is prepared right now to renegotiate with its teachers a contract that would have teachers teaching in school that much. And lots of things would have to change in order for a contract like that to work. They're able to make that contract work because they don't have unionized teachers, which does not mean that unionized teachers would not necessarily go for a contract like that, but just that it would have to look very different than the current contract. And I think the state of the relations between people in teachers' unions and people who are heading up the reform movement is fractured enough that it's, yes, going to be hard to create a deal like that where, say, the Milwaukee Public Schools could have certain schools that are run on a KIPP-like model while still being unionized and still being part of the regular public school system. I'd love to see that happen, but I think there's a lot of political reasons why it's not going to happen. In terms of the other evidence-based programs that I was talking about, like the early childhood programs, I think there are political obstacles there as well, like Head Start, for instance. Now, so Head Start, there are lots of good things about the Head Start program. It certainly seems to help kids who are enrolled in it to a certain degree. But there's also lots of evidence that it is not doing anywhere near as good a job as it should be doing. And it doesn't have a long-term impact with most of the kids who are enrolled in it. But we don't really have a debate about Head Start quality. Instead, we just have a debate about Head Start funding. And so, you know, the charactered version of it is that Democrats want to spend extra billions of dollars on Head Start, and Republicans want to cut extra billions of dollars from Head Start. But I think those two sides are so stuck in the debate over funding that we're not willing to say, okay, well, what would Head Start actually look like if we were able to create a system that was going to give 3- and 4-year-old low-income kids the best possible supports that we could design? And supporters of Head Start are nervous, I think, about having that conversation because they worry that once they open the doors to that conversation, opponents of Head Start are going to say, well, you're admitting that Head Start doesn't work, so let's just cut funding altogether. So I think in both of those examples and lots of others, there are these political reasons. The debate has become so intense that we can't just say, let's all get together, figure out what works, and figure out how we can apply that to the systems we have now.
And I want to spend just a moment here when you talk about the results being good from some of the knowledge is power charter schools. How should we be measuring results? What does that mean? That you read books for the rest of your life? That you get a good job that pays you a lot of money? That you, what is it?
It's a very good question. So I think you know, in the short term, the main way that they measure their success is in test scores, high school graduation, and college graduation. I think all of those things are good and important. I think there's lots of evidence from all over the place, most recently from Atlanta, that focusing too much on test scores can lead to all sorts of problems with school systems, including cheating by teachers. I don't think that that's happened in the KIPP schools, but I think on a state level or on a national level, that can certainly be true. But I don't really have a better way of measuring how much kids are learning. One of the things that I like about KIPP is that they are very focused. Their real goal is to get 75% of the kids who enter their schools in middle school graduated from college. They don't run colleges. They now run high schools. But they have a system that continues to work with kids in college so that they have the kind of support that they need to graduate from college. And that's often difficult for these kids because they're often the first person in their family to go to college. And there's lots of evidence out there that college is really tough if you don't have a history of college going in your family. And so I like measures that are sort of far down the road like that. And I feel like college graduation is a great one. I don't think it's for everybody, but right now I think 9% of kids from low-income families graduate from four-year colleges, and that just strikes me as way too low. And so focusing on that goal and trying to work backwards from there and figure out what kind of interventions we need to do to raise that number significantly seems like the right approach to me.
Thank you, Kit, so much for your call. Richard in Fort Atkinson, hi.
Hi, thank you. My background is 40 years in university education in this state, and I have quite a few grandchildren who are both elementary and high school teachers. So I've been profoundly interested in education all along, and I think all of our efforts, whether they come from Democrats or Republicans, have been profoundly misguided. And the one bright person that I see on the horizon is Diane Ravitch, not because she's right about everything, but because she started by looking at the program under the education of the Bush administration, and she sees things empirically, and she uses reason to attack the problem. She's not a sentimentalist. And I think she understands our situation, but does not go far enough. Our real problem is that this society always has been, continues to be, profoundly racist. And couple that with our so-called free market capitalist system, and we have developed a culture which is a human throwaway culture. Milwaukee and Baltimore are two signature examples of that. And until you can solve that problem, you will never solve the education problem. We cover it over by devaluing our higher education. Read Academically Adrift. I think you had a program about that issue. You've just mentioned the Atlanta school cheating scandals, and there are not the resources in our urban communities to do the recipe of things that both you and Kathleen have mentioned in terms of community intervention to provide the kind of environment that would make education successful for a child. We live by the lies that we tell ourselves. That's my comment.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you. Those are good comments to take to heart. Paul.
Well, I'll say a couple of things about it. First, about Diane Ravitch. I agree with Richard that she's a very important writer and that she's making a lot of good points. And my piece in the Times Magazine was in large part in support of this op-ed that she wrote. Where I feel like she doesn't go far enough is in figuring out solutions. So her book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, I think is a very strong critique of the education reform movement and points out a lot of flaws in that movement. But when it comes to providing solutions of her own, I feel like that book really falls short. And the way I read it, the main proposal that she has is for a national curriculum. And that to me, when I go into low-income high schools in places like Chicago, it seems like the problems there are not primarily curriculum problems. They go a lot beyond that. So my hope is that the next step that she takes is to really start looking at specific interventions and come up, instead of just with critiques of other reformers, with her own ideas about how in a most sort of focused and targeted way, we could develop new systems. To just briefly address what Richard said about race, there's no question that when you go to schools in low-income neighborhoods, you know, in Chicago, I'll mention again because that's where I've been reporting a lot over the last year, it's impossible not to think about race. I'm white, but most of these schools are 100% black, a lot of the schools that I went to. And you know, we don't have segregated schools anymore, but in lots of neighborhoods we really do, and it's those schools that are the least successful. And I haven't been able to figure out how to address that in terms of finding solutions. I tend to think that if we focus on low-income families and focus on class more than race, we're going to have the best success in making the kind of change that's going to be helpful. But there are certainly some days where I absolutely know what Richard means, and it feels like maybe we do need to have a more robust conversation about race in order to figure out how we want to take on the problems of kids in those neighborhoods and those schools.
Well, and we in Wisconsin, you probably aren't aware of this because you've been concentrating on Chicago, but we face these budget problems, of course, and debts, et cetera. But I'm very familiar with the MPS system because our kids went to school there. Mm-hmm. And we have now a layoff of 354 teachers and 200 support staff. And I'm looking at what class sizes are right now in the MPS system. They can only go up. And they've dropped certain foreign language as subject to be learned. And it seems to me as though Richard makes a point here that there hasn't been a whole lot of concern about this. There hasn't been, well, that's just the way it is. We have to save money. And I keep thinking, these are, for the most part, poor kids, and you're making it harder, I think, in the public school system for them to be able to succeed. Is it a race issue? Is it, what is it? But it just seems, if we need a more educated workforce to fill these kinds of jobs, engineers, et cetera, that where you can find employment and help the world, we're not moving in that direction.
And one of the things that's amazing to me, yeah, I don't know the numbers for Milwaukee specifically, but I'm guessing they're not too different than they are in some other cities, is with the resegregation of a lot of our schools and with a lot of middle class and upper middle class families leaving the public school system, there are now school systems that essentially are almost entirely low-income and
yes.
minority.
Yes.
I reported in New Orleans a few years ago, and that's absolutely true there. But it's also true, I was surprised to find in Chicago, just working on this piece for the Times Magazine, I was trying to compare the demographic numbers for this one particular charter school that Arne Duncan had held up as an example with the demographics of the school system as a whole. And I was surprised to find that the Chicago public school system for the whole city, 86% of students are low income, and 91% of them are non-white. And you know, Chicago is a pretty diverse city, but the middle class white kids just are not represented in their public school system. And I think that creates a system where it's really difficult for people as citizens, as voters, to feel the kind of connection to the school system that they used to.
Right. Very good point. Very good point. Richard, thanks for the call. Tom in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hello. I'm a teacher in Milwaukee here, and I want to ask a question, but then let me explain it a little bit. My question is, have you ever worked in an urban school? Because every time they have a show like this, an NPR or anywhere, they always have these experts that come on, and none of them have actually worked in an urban school. And I always feel like the conversation, there's like a disconnect between what you're talking about and what I experienced.
What are we not covering, Tom? Help us out.
Well, how much of a person's education comes from their home? John Hagelin did a good study. He's a Nobel Prize-winning laureate in economics. And he looked at schools, and he saw that schools pretty much always add the same amount, no matter where you look. It's what you bring to the table. So if you, and I guess I've seen these movies, and they talk about, only 30% of the kids that go to this school are ready to go to college when they graduate. Well, how did those 30% get the education? The teachers are all doing the same job with all the kids, I mean, by and large. It's what the kids bring to the table. If you bring nothing to the table, then you're not going to succeed.
Well, I'm happy to take that on. And James Heckman is actually someone who I've been reporting on a lot, both in my last book and especially in this new book. I think his ideas are really important. To answer your first question, no, I have never taught at all in a low-income school or anywhere else. I've worked a lot as a journalist in these schools and visited and spent time in the classroom and talking to kids in lots of different low-income schools. And the issue that you're raising is exactly the one that I'm addressing in this piece in the Times Magazine, but also in other writing that I do, which is that out of school factors are really important in terms of the success of kids. And I know the chart that you're talking about that James Heckman, the economist, has come up with. When you look at the divergence in terms of achievement test results, they stay mostly the same throughout a school system. That if you divide kids by maternal education, if your mother graduated from college, went to some college, dropped out of high school, you're going to start in kindergarten with a big gap between those groups, and you're going to finish at the end of high school with almost exactly the same gap between those groups. But to me, that's the premise, that's the beginning of the conversation rather than the end of the conversation, because obviously that system, that situation is not good. It's not really one that I think we can be comfortable with. And I think that there is lots of evidence that even if that is true on a national level, that is not true for every kid and every school and every school system. And so we need to figure out a way to change that, to have more mobility, to have kids who come from disadvantaged homes find paths to doing better. And I think that there are some teachers and some schools that are doing a fantastic job of making that happen. And I think that there are lots of other interventions outside of schools that can make it easier for those teachers, that can get kids to that first day of kindergarten in a much better place than they would be otherwise, even if they come from a really disadvantaged home. So my whole project right now, everything that I'm working on, is to try to find the answers to those questions. So I absolutely share your premise, but I just think that it's the beginning of figuring out what to do rather than the end of the story.
Thank you, Tom. John and Marinette, hi.
Hi. I'd like you to comment on the Finnish educational system, which for the last 10 years has consistently scored in the top one or two spots, reading, science, etc. They do not have grades. Children do not receive ABC grades. It's a public education system. They do not spend more time in the classroom, but rather focus on each individual child and their goals. At the beginning of the year, each child sits down with their teacher and lists out what they'd like to accomplish. The teachers work to obtain it. They have no more than 20 children per classroom, and they're, so to speak, kicking the butt of the United States and much of the world. It's a place where, as one person said, a child can be a child, and yet they have very high achievement.
Are you familiar with that system, Paul?
Just a little bit. Over the last year, as different rankings have come out talking about how different countries do in terms of international academic achievement, lots of people have been talking about Finland, and it's actually raised by both sides. I think it can be an example that people use to prove all sorts of points. We should be paying teachers differently, changing class size, being more like Finland, and I don't know a whole lot about it. I haven't studied the Finnish system, and so I can't get into details about what I think works there and doesn't. But I also think it's a very different country than ours, and they have a different class system, a different system of race, different history than we do, and I think that all of that is really important as well. And so I don't think that the answer is as simple as just taking the Finnish system and putting it into the south side of Chicago, because I think that the needs are really different in those different places. So I absolutely think that our goal should be to kick Finland's butt and to be performing as well as those highest performing countries, but I'm not convinced that the answer is simply to imitate what they're doing.
I feel like I need a story here, so I want you to tell me a story. Maybe it's what Jeffrey Canada has done. Maybe it's an experience that you've had in a very unlikely place, unlikely state, unlikely school. But I want to hear a success story. I want to hear a story of high-poverty kids, rough lives, no money in the family, teenage parents, perhaps, and they go to school, and the school can just lift them.
Sure.
Thank you. Okay.
I've definitely been meeting a lot of those kids in the reporting on the book that I'm doing. I'm going to go back to Chicago to talk about one particular program and one particular kid who I met there. A girl just graduated from high school named Kiwana, who I met a couple of years ago, African-American girl from a really difficult home, lots of problems in her life growing up, definitely a very low-income home, but also family separation, substance abuse history in her family, lots of moves, lots of legal troubles. And she, when she got to high school, was doing terribly. She was in the slow class. She was fighting all the time. She was getting suspended all the time. And mostly, to hear her tell it, just because she was angry. She just had a really difficult life, and she felt mad all the time. She now graduated from high school and is going to starting a four-year college in Western Illinois this fall. And so I've spent a lot of time trying to figure out what happened to her and what it was that changed. And I think it's a couple things. I think it was partly her and a certain moment that happened early in her high school career when her mom and her grandmother sat her down and said, you can have a different life than the life that we've had, and the power is within you to change that. So in lots of ways, it is about the power of the home, of the family, to send a different sort of message, and really transforms kids' lives, even late in their academic career. But she also connected with this program called Us Empowered, which I've spent a lot of time writing about in Chicago. And they are in her high school and a few other high schools. It's a three-year program that tries to get low-income kids without a history of college in their family to and through college. So it starts in, recruits kids in sophomore year and then teaches them in junior and senior year and then continues to work with them in the first year of college. And what it's really about is it's partly about academic preparation, but it's more about personality preparation. It's more about preparing these kids for a different way of thinking, for thinking of themselves as successful, as potential students. A lot of them still have pretty low test scores on the ACT and other tests. But rather than take that as an excuse or as an insurmountable obstacle, this program is trying to teach them how the personality skills they have, the resourcefulness and ambition and leadership qualities that they have, can overcome a lot of those deficits. So what I take from that is partly that it's never too late, that, you know, for all of the emphasis that I and others put on starting early and the importance of the first few years of life, it is possible to take kids who are 15 and 16, who are well behind, and by telling them a really convincing story about how their life can turn out, get them to put so much more intensity into their schoolwork than they have before, and that can carry kids a really long way.
Oh, thanks for that story. And I don't know where you are, but as you were telling it, this bird started singing in the background. Did you hear that?
That's probably in my backyard. Yes. Oh, I just added a sound effects record that I put on to try to make it more convincing.
I don't think you had time to do that. More phone calls in just one moment. Our guest this hour is Paul Tough. Many of you, I'm sure, read his piece that was in the New York Times Sunday magazine, No Seriously, No Excuses, in which he looks at education reform. He's well-versed on the topic because he is the author of Whatever It Takes, Jeffrey Canada's Quest to Change Harlem and America, and his next book is The Success Equation, which will be published next year. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our next caller is Beatrice near Viroqua. Hi, Beatrice.
Hello.
Hello.
I was listening to your program in the car, and I came in the house, and so now I'm settling down and listening to us. I taught school forever, everything from little kids in country schools to high school, junior high, but my biggest thing that I wanted to talk about, I traveled through Europe studying schools and daycare centers there, and I like the idea that they have, and I don't know, but I think it could work here, where you divide the children earlier into a technical school or an academic school. And the ones that are in the academic school, then they're not causing any problems. And the ones in the lower ones have a incentive to do better because they're working with things that they want to do, like being a mechanic or a bricklayer, and that somebody will say, well, this is discrimination to divide them like that. And then I always say, have you paid a carpenter lately or a mechanic lately?
Right.
It's definitely not discrimination. Then somebody said, but what if they can't read? And I said, then you print comic books that tell them how to put a car together. And I know this is works because I had a disadvantaged class in a junior high, and I had to do their regular work, and then they could go up and get a comic book. And it did help for them to excel in their grades.
Where did you teach, Beatrice?
In La Crosse. In fact, one of my students in that is our congressman now, Ron Kind.
Oh, really?
Yes, and he mentioned he was introducing Mrs. Clinton one time, and he said, before I do that, I'd like to tell three people that helped me get in politics. And then he mentioned his grade school teacher and his neighbor and me.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That's great. Congratulations. You never know. You never know how what you've done is going to turn out. And sometimes it's really good. Paul.
Absolutely great to hear from Beatrice and salute her for all the work that she's done. It sounds like she's a great teacher. I have some sympathy for the idea that she's mentioning of encouraging kids to follow technical careers or to get better sort of apprenticeship training. I really worry about it in an American context, partly because of what some of the earlier callers were talking about, that we already have a very segregated system and a system where, you know, certain kids are entering the school system and entering high school, certainly, with lower skills. And my impression is that those, you know, the kids who tend to be entering with lower skills statistically are kids from low-income homes and kids from minority homes. And I think there's if you look at what's happened earlier in their, both in their lives and in their school careers, there's really no reason for them to be doing, no good reason for them to be doing so much worse. So my worry is that a system like this, rather than looking at those inequities and saying, how can we correct those, and how can we give kids all the same sort of opportunities, would instead perpetuate those inequities. I absolutely agree that you know, carpenters and plumbers and those sorts of technical jobs are great jobs and often very well-paying jobs. I just want people from all different types of homes to have the choice of what kind of career they want. And so if they want to take those sorts of jobs, whether they grow up rich or poor, then they absolutely should have that option. But if they want to go through college and have a professional career, they should have all the support they need at home, in school, outside of school, to get them there.
Beatrice, thank you so much for your call. Ellen in Brookfield. Hi. Hi, Ellen. I don't know where you are, so we'll have to say goodbye. Chris in Hurley. Hi.
Yeah, this is Chris in Hurley.
Yes.
A quick point to get on Beatrice's point, not to discount it, but those technical jobs, they're called technical jobs for a reason, because they're technical. So you still need to know how to read and write and articulate and everything like that. My original point was with the Finland system, where there are no grades and you know, that can be very difficult with the whole American mindset, because although you're identifying goals and trying to reach those goals, if a child all the way through college or all the way up to college has never received a grade, and then they go to college and they get a grade and it's a bad grade, I don't think they'll be able to handle it. And the whole point of a public school system is to get people ready to join our society and be productive. And if you get an A in life, you get to keep your job, you get to make it, you get a house, everything like that. If you get a C, you're not going to be able to keep your job, and you won't make it.
Paul.
I definitely take Chris's point. I mean, I am sympathetic to the case against testing and the idea that we just put way too much emphasis on that and subject these kids to too much pressure as a result. But I think Chris is right that, you know, life is like that. So that there are lots of tests in life and lots of things you need to study for and lots of high-stakes moments where you have to perform well. And so if that's, I agree that that shouldn't be all that, that a child experiences in school, especially early in school, in kindergarten and elementary school. But the fact that that's part of a school career doesn't seem wrong at all to me. It seems actually like good preparation for the world after school.
Thank you, Chris, so much. When is your book out?
It's out next September, September 2012.
Oh, okay. So put us down on the calendar.
Thank you. I'd love to come back.
Yeah. You are a marvelous guest. Thank you so much. You're just so knowledgeable, and we have been flooded. Maybe we'll try and send them your way. We have tons of email messages I just couldn't get to and just flooded with phone calls. So you should know that and join us.
Thank you.
Oh, and you have a website?
Yes, my website is just my name, paultuff.com, and there's a link to email me on that site, so people are welcome to contact me directly.
Wonderful. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Our guest this hour, Paul Tuff, his most recent work, No Seriously, No Excuses, is in last Sunday's New York Times Magazine. And he is also the author of Whatever It Takes, Jeffrey Canada's Quest to Change Harlem and America. The new book is The Success Equation. Thanks to who produced the show? Chrissy Peace. Thanks to Chrissy Peace for producing this hour. And thanks to Chrissy Peace for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Thanks, everybody, for being so engaged.